I have grown this food. It's incredibly flavorful because it is fresh from my own backyard or from my farmer's market or my local farmer. And I want to capture that and save it for later in the best way possible, both from a nutrition standpoint and from a flavor standpoint. This is the Living Homegrown Podcast, episode 146.
Welcome to the Living Homegrown Podcast, where it's all about how to live farm fresh without the farm. To help guide the way to a more flavorful and sustainable lifestyle is your host, national PBS TV producer and canning expert, Teresa Lowe.
Hey there, everybody. Welcome to the podcast. I'm your host, Teresa Lowe, and this podcast is where we talk about living farm fresh without a farm, which includes organic small space food growing, canning and fermenting the harvest, and artisan food crafts like baking your own bread. It's all about the different ways that we can live closer to our food and take small, delicious steps towards living a more sustainable lifestyle. If you would like to learn more about any of these topics, or my online courses, my coaching, or my Living Homegrown Institute, which is my membership site, then just visit my website, livinghomegrown.com. Today's episode is a Q&A episode. I'm going solo on this one. I have not done a Q&A episode in quite a while. We have been batching the podcast for the last few months, which means that I set aside maybe 2 days and I just record maybe 6 or 7 podcasts with different people that I interview over those 2 days. And then we have them all set up to go out over the next 6 or 7 weeks. And it really works great for me because then I'm not trying to, you know, scramble to put together a podcast at the last minute. But the downside is that because I've been concentrating so much with my team on scheduling people out for those days, I kind of neglected doing solo episodes. And I had a few people write to me and ask, you know, when are you going to do another solo episode? I've had several people write in with questions. And then finally, my team said, you know, you haven't done a solo in like a couple months. So I decided now is the time. I'm doing a solo episode today. And I went through kind of the bucket list of all the questions that my team's been collecting for a while. And I picked out a few that all have to do with the same topic. And that topic is canning, right? When this comes out, it will be the May going into June timeframe. And that means that a lot of you are gearing up your gardens and you're starting to think about harvesting and you're starting to think about canning. So I thought this would be a good time to dive into that topic. We haven't covered canning in a long time. Now, those of you who have been a longtime follower of the Living Homegrown podcast, you know that I used to cover canning and preserving a lot. And then we have slowly branched into really all aspects of living a farm fresh lifestyle. But those of you who are newer to my podcast, you may not know my background in canning. So here's the scoop. I grew up canning and preserving. I grew up in Los Angeles, but with a family who loved to grow their own food. So we did a lot of canning and preserving growing up just because my parents loved to do that. But we always approached it from as an art form, you know, culinary arts as an art form. And I later was trained as a master food preserver, and I went through culinary school. But I also have a BS degree in engineering. My family is a family of engineers. I grew up around engineering and I went on to get a degree in engineering, although obviously that is not where I took my whole life path. I only worked as an engineer for, I don't know, maybe 8 or 10 years as an aerospace engineer. And then I went into gardening and food and television and completely shifted away from the engineering field. However, when I look at canning and preserving, and when I have taught canning and preserving or with my Canning Academy or any of my Living Homegrown Institute courses, I always love to approach things where I am teaching the reasons behind the techniques. And that's because I get really kind of geeked out on the science behind some of the reasons that we have the rules for safety. And I also, because I went through culinary school, I approach canning and all types of preserving from a foodie standpoint. To me, it's all about capturing that seasonal flavor in the jar or that seasonal flavor in whatever preservation method we're using. I have grown this food. It's incredibly flavorful because it is fresh from my own backyard or from my farmer's market or my local farmer, and I want to capture that and save it for later in the best way possible, both from a nutrition standpoint and from a flavor standpoint. So whenever you hear me talking about canning and preserving, that's where I'm coming from. Also, I do homestead on 1/10 of an acre in Los Angeles. We grow some of our own food. I also shop local farmers markets. We have backyard chickens, and my family has property up in Northern California. We have 14 acres of an heirloom farmstead that we are in the process of restoring. So we have a lot of heirloom fruit trees up there that I'm in charge of restoring back to their former glory. And so I have a lot of experience with canning and preserving both at the farmstead and with my own small plot here in Los Angeles. So when I talk about canning, that's where I'm coming from. I absolutely adore the subject and I love to share it with everybody else. So that's what's in it for today. And before we dive into the episode, I wanted to tell you that today's episode is brought to you by Living Homegrown Institute, which is my monthly membership site where you can access an entire library of monthly masterclasses that help you live a farm fresh lifestyle. Now, I believe that living an organic farm fresh lifestyle is really a journey in learning. And just as we have different skills such as food fermentation and food growing and even critter keeping, there are three distinct stages of growth. We start out with just being curious, and then we go into experimentation, and eventually we grow into mastery of these different skills. Now, if you are looking at creating a farm fresh lifestyle for yourself and you're curious where you may fall on the growth scale of the different skills, I've got a great free resource for you. It's my Farm Fresh Success Path, and it's what my students use inside my Learning Institute, and it will help you decide where you are on your own journey, the characteristics of that particular stage, and some action steps and information to help you go to the next level. To get to the Success Path PDF, you can just go to livinghomegrown.com/path, and I will have everything there for you to download for free. All right, so let's dive into today's Q&As. The first question is from Chastity, and she wrote, I have been told by other organic gardeners that canning is the worst possible way to preserve your food because during the canning process of reaching such high temperatures, almost 90% of the good enzymes and nutrients are destroyed. They say that besides just eating raw or very lightly stir-fried food, that it's better to dehydrate than it is to can. I'm really confused because I'm new to all of this and I'm just coming into converting myself and my family into an organic, homegrown, homesteading lifestyle. Please help and thank you so much. I absolutely love your podcast. Well, Chastity, I'm so glad you asked this question. It is really a fantastic question because knowing what is most important to you when you are preserving the food will really determine which is the best method and what you plan to do with that preserved food when you go to use it or cook it. So let's talk about that. First of all, yes, it is true that enzymes are killed during canning. Now, how much they are killed or if all of them are killed depends upon what method you are using for canning, such as pressure canning versus water bath. Pressure canning goes up to a much higher temperature. And yes, the higher temperatures can disable many, if not most, of the enzymes. And yes, those same enzymes can survive when dehydrated. So if enzymes are your ultimate goal, then canning is not the process to use for preserving your food. Instead, you would want to go for things like fermentation. That would be my first choice. Then dehydration or freezing, which does kill some, but not all of the enzymes. So you might be thinking, well, wait a minute, how does freezing kill some of the enzymes. Well, when you are freezing vegetables, you are supposed to blanch the vegetables very quickly, and the purpose of that is to kill the enzymes that cause the food to soften or continue to break down while they are in the freezer. So even though you're freezing, the point is to kill some of those enzymes before you freeze. So I just want to make sure that you understand that with food preservation, we are slowing down the process of that food breaking down and decomposing. We're just slowing it down. We're not stopping it completely. So when you are trying to decide between different food preservation methods, you have to look at a couple different things, such as what are you going to do with that food when you go to consume it? Most people like to cook their food when it comes to things like tomato sauce and stews with tomatoes. Most of the people who are canning tomatoes will be cooking those tomatoes when they go to use them. So since cooking will kill the enzymes anyway, then it doesn't really matter if you can it first. Also, most people would rather use canned tomatoes rather than dehydrated tomatoes for their recipes. So in that case, canning might be the way to go. Now, in the case of pickles, if you wanted to do pickling for your vegetables, let's say, pickling is much more nutritious if you do real fermentation versus a quick pickle that is when you are using vinegar to do the pickling process. So real fermentation is when you are allowing the bacteria to ferment in the jar and turn that vegetable into a pickle, into a high acid product. The downside of a fermented pickle is that it won't sit on the shelf as long as a canned pickle with vinegar without changing flavor and texture. And that is because it will continue to change and evolve because the fermentation process is still happening. Even if you put it in the refrigerator, that fermented pickle will slowly, ever so slowly, continue to change in flavor and texture. So if long-term storage is what you're after, then canning would be the way to go in that case as well. With long-term storage, you are forfeiting the beneficial bacteria in order to have the food on the shelf longer, like if you wanted to prep for emergencies or you wanted to have those tomatoes or that vegetable on the shelf for a really long period of time. And in the case of something like jams or jellies, well, a dehydrated jam is probably not that practical. So you probably would not dehydrate something as a jam unless you were going to make like fruit leather with it. That would be different than jam. So most of the time when people are making jam, it's not for nutritional reasons. And yes, you can make jam with low sugar and no sugar. I'm going to talk about that in another question here on this episode. But in most cases, people are making jam more as a treat for something that they would spread on toast. And in that case, canning is usually the way to go. So what I'm trying to say here is that we have different foods that we're wanting to eat at different levels of preservation for and store them for different lengths of time. And a mix is probably ultimately what you want. So if you want enzymes and vitamins and minerals, then eat fruits and vegetables either fresh or raw with no cooking. That is absolutely the best way to get the nutrition. The next one down from that in terms of nutrition would be to either ferment or freeze or dehydrate. But for long-term storage or for things that are going to be cooked anyway, or for something like jam that is just a treat and you're not going for nutrition, then you could look to canning as your way of preserving the food. So in other words, there are different choices of food preservation based on what is the most priority for you with that food, whether it's nutrition, enzymes, or long-term storage. So I hope that answered your question. I thought it was an excellent question. The next question is from Sherry, and she says, I have an apricot tree where all the fruit comes on at once. I want to make apricot jam as Christmas gifts this summer, and I want to do it in large batches. However, all the jam recipes say I can't double the recipe. Why is that? Okay, so yes, Sherry, when you are looking at any jam or jelly recipe, it will tell you that you should not double the recipe. And that's because all jam recipes are, they're like developed to cook the jam within a certain amount of time. If you double the recipe, you're going to double the cooking time. And that can be a really big problem. This is because with larger or longer cooking times, you affect the water content. More water is burned off when you cook over a longer period of time. And this can affect the flavor of the jam as well as cause some other problems. Basically, you end up overcooking the jam. And when you overcook jam, it becomes really hard and unspreadable in texture. It turns into more like a gummy bear than it is a jelly, if that makes sense. So first, I should say that if that ever happens to you, if you ever overcook a jam, you can still use it if the flavor is good. So if you taste it and the flavor is awesome, but it's more like a gummy bear and you can't spread it on your toast, don't throw it away because you can still use that hardened jam for sauces and glazes. You can melt some in a pan with a little bit of water and pour it over a turkey or a chicken. You can make a finishing sauce to go over steaks and just so many wonderful things you can do with that. And if it's really solid, like it is a solid gummy bear type texture, then you can slice it and serve it with cheese and crackers. I swear it is incredible. So don't throw it away if you ever overcook it, as long as the flavor is still good. But if you do double a recipe and you get that longer cooking time, so not only do you end up overcooking it because too much water gets evaporated off, but also it affects the pectin. The pectin gets overcooked and you usually end up burning the jam before it gels. So part of this is because when you are cooking the jam, you are reaching a certain temperature with the jam. And when you double it, it takes twice as long to bring that entire pot up to the temperature that causes the gel. And if you're ever doing something like cherries, for example, cherries burn really easily. So if you double the recipe, you're pretty much guaranteed you're going to burn that jam rather than ending up with anything that gels or isn't burnt. So I do not recommend that you double the recipe. So what should you do if you want to make a lot of jam at once? Well, the safest thing, honestly, is that you make multiple recipes instead of doubling. So you set aside an afternoon and you prep for several recipes at once and you do them in succession, one at a time. That is absolutely the safest way to do it, where you won't overcook the jam and you should get a good gel and a good flavor at the end. Now, some will argue, well, what about commercial kitchens? They are making large batches, so it has to be possible, right? Oh, yes, it's absolutely possible. It does take a little bit of trial and error, and you really need to use like a commercial-sized pan that has a heavy bottom, and you bring it up to a really high heat so that you are cooking the jam in the same amount of time as you would if it was a single batch. So yes, it's possible, but it's tricky. And unless you kind of know what you're doing, you end up overcooking the jam or burning it. So what I recommend for the best success is just to do the single batches one at a time, but you can do them in succession. Set aside an afternoon or have someone help you and you are each doing a batch of jam at the same time. I've done that before with my mom, where we're each on a pot and we're making a double batch by each of us making a batch at the same time. So that is possible as well. So I don't want to discourage you. I think you could definitely like spend an afternoon and make several batches. And if you want to try doing a double batch, just know that you might end up with a different texture. So test it out before you really go to town and do multiple double batches. Now, I'm sure that's not the answer that you wanted, but definitely if you want the best success, that's what I would recommend. Okay, the next question is from Maya, and she says, I have some jam that is over a year old. Is it still good? Okay, well, first of all, Maya, you didn't specify what type of jam it was, how much over a year it is, if it looks good on the shelf, if you've verified it's still sealed. So it's hard for me to answer that question without actually seeing it myself. But let me talk to you about some guidelines on how you can tell if a jam is good or not. I should probably start by saying that the USDA guidelines for canning recommends that a jam is good for a year on the shelf. Now, are jams able to be longer than a year? Absolutely. Now, here's the thing. There are really two things to consider when you are looking at a jam and wondering if it's good to eat. The first is safety, of course, and the second is quality. So let's talk about safety first. As long as the seal is good and you see no signs of spoilage, a jar of jam does last longer than a year. So I would be okay with a jam being up to 2 years old on my shelf if I know the seal is good and I can verify that there are no signs of spoilage. But what you usually end up with is a jam that before you hit that 2 year mark, you end up throwing it away because of quality, not because of safety. So let's talk about quality for a second. Now, when I'm talking here, I'm talking about a standard high sugar jam. I'm talking about a recipe that uses a lot of sugar to get that pectin acid sugar ratio to get a gel. So your standard typical jam that you would find on the back of a box of pectin is what I'm going to talk about first. And then I'll talk about the low and no sugar pectins. Okay, so when we're talking about a jam that has a lot of sugar in there, the sugar is there to create this chemical reaction that causes the gel. But that sugar is also a very powerful preservative. And the quality might last well past a year in terms of flavor and color because of that high sugar content. What usually goes first with that type of jam is the texture. After about a year to 18 months, the texture can start to get a little funky on you. It starts to get a little runny, it kind of weeps, and sometimes it even gets a little grainy. So when you're looking at quality, we're looking at flavor, color, and texture. And with high sugar jams, after I've inspected that the seal is good and there's no signs of spoilage, the next thing I look at is the texture. And if the texture is still good, the flavor and color are usually good as well with a high sugar jam. And that's because the sugar has been acting as a preservative. Now, let's talk about low and no sugar jams because it's kind of a different situation. In those jams, the gel is created, if you're using a box of low or no sugar pectin, the gel is created not from sugar, but from a pectin calcium ratio. There's calcium in that box of pectin, and that's what causes it to gel. Or you may make more of a fruit spread that's more natural, where you add no added pectin, and that's where you're just using the natural sugar and pectin in the fruit with maybe some lemon to get a little acid, and you have this balance where you get a gel with temperature. Now, in both of those cases, the only sugar that is in there is the natural sugar in the fruit. So you don't have the high sugar giving you the preservative aspect that you do in a regular jam. So the benefit of a low or no sugar jam is that there's no sugar that's added to that. So it's more natural and it's a little bit healthier than a typical jam with high sugar. The downside is that because it's lower in sugar, you don't have that extra preservative in there that can give it a longer shelf life. And that means that low and no sugar jams tend to kind of go downhill faster on the shelf. Now, in terms of safety, a low or no sugar jam basically is the same. You want to make sure that it's sealed, that there's no signs of spoilage, and it should stay sealed on the jar just fine for a year to 2 years. That's usually not where the problem is. The problem is usually that by 1 year, a low or no sugar jam tends to have really poor quality. Everything starts to go with a low and no sugar jams. The flavor and texture and color go, and of the three things, the color goes first. So within just a month or two of canning it, the color starts to turn brown and kind of go downhill, which is fine. That's just, aesthetics. It doesn't affect the flavor. The second thing to go is the texture. It will start to get runny, maybe a little grainy. It'll get lumpy. So the texture is next. And then the third thing is, yes, the flavor will start to deteriorate as it sits on the shelf. So with low or no sugar jams, they tend to start to go after 6 months. And by a year, only occasionally have I had a jam really last past a year when it's a low or no sugar jam. It might make it to 18 months, but it rarely goes past that. So where I might eat a high sugar jam after 18 months, I rarely have a low or no sugar jam that would make it that long. But the bottom line is you have to look at each jar of jam as an individual case, and you want to check the safety of the jar, making sure that it's still sealed, it hasn't been leaking, there's no signs of spoilage, and you want to look at the quality of flavor, texture, and color before you consume the jar. So hopefully that gives you some guidelines as to if your jar is still okay after a year. You have to look at it case by case. Okay, well, those were really good questions. And if you have any canning questions, I would love to hear from you. You can submit your questions on our website at livinghomegrown.com. Go to our contact page and send me any questions that you would like me to cover here on the podcast. And as always, in the show notes for today's episode, I have lots more information about canning and preserving. Just go to livinghomegrown.com/146, and I'll have everything there for you. Today's podcast episode was brought to you by my monthly membership site, Living Homegrown Institute, where you can have access to an entire library of monthly masterclasses to help you live a farm fresh lifestyle. If you'd like to get the free PDF success path that my students use inside my membership, then just go to livinghomegrown.com/path, and I'll have everything there for you for free. That's it for today's episode. I hope this information helped you get geared up for canning season, which is just around the corner. So until next time, just try to live a little more local, seasonal, and homegrown. Take care.
That's all for this episode of the Living Homegrown Podcast. Visit livinghomegrown.com to download Teresa's free canning resource guide and find more tips on how to live farm fresh without the farm. Be sure to join Teresa Lowe next time on the Living Homegrown Podcast.